ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. Landholders across the Territory love the NAFI website and they use it every day to check for bushfires. But as you'll learn today, this important website is facing a satellite problem.
It's now detecting a lot less hotspots than it used to. And that means it's much more prone now, we think, to missing fires.
So what's the problem and can it be fixed? You'll find out soon. Also this afternoon, you'll meet the latest company that's on the hunt for rare earths in the Northern Territory. And we are on Monsoon Trough Watch this afternoon. Where is the monsoon? I'll be speaking to the Weather Bureau at 1:05 to get the very latest. This is the Country Hour. We're broadcasting right across the Territory on the ABC. And g'day there if you've tuned in via our podcast. Wellard Limited was once Australia's largest live export business. But these days it has zero ships and is no longer on the ASX. Wellard delisted from the stock exchange last week and now seems on a path to winding up completely. Jess Baker spoke to Wellard's chairman, John Klepek, about the journey to this point and what, if anything, happens next.
10 years, we started off, we had five ships plus one ship in the shipyard in Croatia to be built. So we would have been a six-ship company. And yes, 10 years later, that was on the public listing of Wellard, which was almost 10 years to the day that we delisted just the week just gone. So yeah, it's been a big ride. There's been a lot of rough seas. There's been positives, but there's been a lot of headwinds that the company encountered. And look, ships are a very high-cost business when you're shipping. A ship is not like a car where you just park up when it's got no work. You still have to keep a crew on board. It still consumes fuel. It's quite expensive. And we had, for a period of time, we had ships idling with no work for, the larger ships went almost, one of the ships went nearly a year without work. So with the debt that was combined with that, we had to make the decision to pay back the debt. So we had to sell the ships. Fortunately, we did have a very high quality and high class fleet that made the ships appealing to the limited buyers that were out there. So steadily, we've ended, all the debt was repaid, 100 cents in the dollar. The shareholders have ended up with almost 20 cents return, which, albeit it's less than the original listing price. At one stage, I think the lowest we got down to was around 1 cent. So people formed the view the company would go under. So we did have a rocky time. So it's a confluence of factors, but primarily it's the decline in the market.
It sounds like there were a lot of contributing factors.
Yes, there's no one thing, but the underlying thing was the poor trading markets. From listing, they went in a steady decline. For Wellard, the main market was cattle to Indonesia and Vietnam. Breeding cattle to China was a lucrative market for a period of time, and that's now stopped as well. And then it's the South American to, predominantly Brazil to Turkey was a market that Christmas Eve, Christmas Eve, I think it was 2018, the market closed just with the drop of with legislation overnight. So we went from having ships employed to that's the last shipment, and a market absolutely closed.
Over time, the fleet's been sold off to, I guess, meet financial obligations. And I understand the Ocean Drover was the last ship to go back in August this year.
Yes.
So once that happened, was delisting pretty much inevitable, would you say?
Yeah, we did look at other options. But being, on the smaller side, to be a listed company is quite onerous in terms of the obligations that are imposed. And unless you're of a critical size, which Wellard wasn't, being listed, it doesn't justify the costs of it. And, you stay listed if you're going to raise more money and you have a growth vision which the company originally had, which is the reason why it went public, where you're going to tap the market for more funds, et cetera, equity to expand. So given the opportunities that presented once we sold the last ship, predominantly in the agri space, we formed the opinion that a delisting And look, the company is only staying alive because it has the we're claiming in the Brett class action, which we expect to receive something in the end of the day. That's a long process. You know, it's 2011. We're now 14 years down the track and still hasn't resolved. So we've probably, one might say we're optimistic that there's an outcome in the next 2 to 3 years. But the critical part of that will be the next appeal, which is early next year. So we remain an unlisted public company. So we haven't closed up shop. We're not liquidated. We're still alive, but not in a listed form.
That's the Northern Territory-based Brett Cattle Company class action.
Correct.
You're referring
Correct.
To?
We're a claimant, and we're of the opinion today that there will be a payment eventually made. When and the quantum is unknown, but just on a straight cost benefit analysis, we have formed the view that it's worth staying an unlisted public company while that event goes through its courses. The next point will be, the appeal that is occurring next year. Once that occurs, we'll have another view of where that case is going to go. And if we form the view that there isn't a positive outcome for us, that we will then seek to wind the company up completely.
Looking ahead, what do you see as the future for live exports from Australia?
Oh, very, at the moment, it's very positive. The market is back to, good volumes. I don't follow it as closely as I once did, obviously, but I know the pricing is very good in terms for the producers. You know, beef pricing is good. We are getting up to, once you get it over that $4 level, it does become a problematic for the Indonesians. So I would like to see, the producers do something for the Indonesian market to ensure that they still get their 500 to, $750,000 head to keep those feedlots alive. The last time the price went up, the producers sent the cattle south, and that caused all sorts of problems with the feedlots in Indonesia. I wouldn't like to see that happen again. So that's the only potential negative I see at the moment. If you have sustained high prices, the producers, I know it's very difficult to do, but the producers do have to effectively quarantine, $500,000 to $1 million head of cattle every year to keep that market alive. And it's very price sensitive. Otherwise, you start getting Indian buffalo come back into the market and Brazilian beef also come into the market, and you won't recover that position. So other than that, I think the industry is in good shape.
And just finally, how concerned do you think the northern cattle industry should be about the ageing live export fleet?
Extremely, because the last ship built was the Ocean Shearer. The new ship purpose-built was 2016. You know, we've been advocates of, ships beyond 25 years should not be allowed to come to Australia for a variety of reasons. I won't go in because it's not for me to comment. We're not in the industry anymore. It's not for me to comment. But ship safety and animal safety is closely linked to ship age and quality of ship and management of ship. So new ships need to be built, simple as that. Otherwise, the people that have, you could get into a situation where there's only one provider or two providers of ships and they're too old. We were proponents of, producers being involved in the economics of a ship, i.e. Have a shareholding in the ship. They're very expensive to build now, as anyone who's doing anything on the capital work side of things. The price of all capital goods have increased greatly, and ships are very expensive, and you're not going to get someone to build a brand new ship unless they have someone underlying it with some sort of supply contract. In the iron ore world or the LNG world, you build a tanker or a super carrier, you're backed up with a 10-year contract, guaranteed price, guaranteed volumes. In the live export world, you're looking shipment to shipment, 3 months is about all you get, and pricing is variable depending on the underlying market, and that's not sustainable for someone to put huge amounts of capital into a ship. It's a great industry. Wellard was in it for was a stalwart. You look at the history of the I think it's 50 or 60 years. Wellard was the major player, and I think a lot of the people in the north, everyone knows Wellard, and I think a lot of them would shed a tear that Wellard's gone. But we go forward and there will be a new Wellard that will take the place and move forward.
That is John Klepek, who is the chairman of Wellard Limited, once Australia's largest live export business and now pretty much done and dusted. Just waiting on the results of that live export class action, which is due back in the courtroom about March of next year. John was speaking there to our Kimberley reporter, Jess Baker.
Hey everyone, my name is Bernard England and I'm a sawmill worker in Manugura community. And you're listening to the Country Hour on ABC.
To some other business news, SunCable has neither confirmed or denied that it's in discussions with Google to build an artificial intelligence data centre near Elliot in the Northern Territory. Matt Garrick reports.
This is essentially the latest headline in a very high-profile project by SunCable, the company that's run by Australian billionaire Mike Cannon-Brookes. They're planning to build a 12,000-hectare solar farm in the Barkly region of the Northern Territory. They're saying next to that project or adjacent to that solar farm, there could also be scope for a expansive artificial intelligence centre to be built. They're basically spruiking it as, well, we've got all this energy and the digital energy industry is very energy intensive. So they're putting the word out there to digital companies to come and build this centre and run it out there in the Barkly using this SunCable energy. Now, there have been some names bandied around who's in discussions about running this facility, potentially building this facility. The most high profile being reported in the Australian newspaper late last week being global tech giant Google. Now, SunCable and Google have both remained pretty tight-lipped about if that's going ahead, if those discussions are actually happening. SunCable's essentially said, look, we're in discussions with companies, with off-takers, using their words. They're not saying with who exactly. They're not confirming if Google is at the table around these plans. Google has been even more cagey about their terminologies. They released a short statement saying essentially they talk to digital companies around the world. They talk to companies around the world about digital infrastructure, and there is no agreement in place with SunCable to build such a artificial intelligence centre in the Northern Territory Outback. That all said, nobody has said those negotiations or those discussions have not happened or are not happening. We're just yet to see if they'll be formalised or they'll come to fruition, or if that artificial intelligence centre will ever actually be built.
That is Matt Garrick with that report. If it'll ever be built, yes, a 12,000-hectare solar farm, a multi-squillion-dollar data centre for artificial intelligence, all on the outskirts of Elliot. Will we ever see it? It's 17 to 1. Text number here at the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. Got a message here from Haggis who says, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Country Hour. We got 102 millimetres here yesterday near Noonamar. Bring on the monsoon, says Haggis. Some other rainfall figures coming in from around the territory. Conway's Station out there on the Central Arnhem Road, 104 millimetres in the gauge. Hidden Valley Station's received 90. Beetaloo Cattle Station, 76 in the gauge. Gove Airport, 67. Victoria River Downs Cattle Station, 55. Birrandoodoo's picked up 54. Bachelor Airport, 48 millimetres. These are decent drops, and there's more to come. If it's raining at your place this afternoon, let the rest of us know. The text number is 0487 99 1057.
G'day, this is Rowan Fisher from Charles Darwin University and North Australia Fire Information, NAFI. I'm sure most of you use it. It's the website that provides all the information for fire management across 80% of Australia. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Yep, the NAFI website. It's one of the most used websites in Northern Australia. Developed by Charles Darwin University, it uses satellite data to give landholders up-to-date information on where fires are burning. But in recent months, there have been reports of long delays in NAFI's map updates, causing concern about the accuracy and the immediacy of this online service. So what is going on? To explain, here is Peter Jacklin, the NAFI service manager with CDU.
There's been a change in the data that we source from overhead satellites that create those maps of active fires. There are satellites, there's about eight of them. They pass overhead regularly throughout the day, and that's what accounts for the fact you have to wait a little bit until a fire is detected, because these things are passing overhead at particular times of day. What's happened is that there's one particular quite important satellite that passes overhead in the morning and detects fires. And that's really useful because it means that you can see if a fire's come alive again, if it's gone out overnight. And what's happened to this satellite is that it's dying. It's the only satellite we have in the morning, and it's 25 years old. It's a minor miracle it's still operating. It's now detecting a lot less hotspots than it used to. And that means it's much more prone now, we think, to missing fires in the morning. And that means that you can be waiting 10, 12 hours sometimes between a fire that was last detected before dawn, say, and doesn't get picked up again until the main satellites pass overhead in the afternoon.
Do you have any idea about when that might be getting updated and how long that could take to get online?
Yes. So there is an agreement. These are all operated, I should say, by US and European space agencies. Australia, we don't have our own satellites like these ones. And for them, they're going to replace this morning satellite by another satellite that's just been launched. But it won't get its hotspot data activated until probably mid-next year. That's because we here in Australia have to develop our own little algorithm that looks at an image of a satellite and picks out those little active fires in that image. And that'll take a little while to develop. So we're looking at mid-next year, but hopefully that'll be before the wildfire season next year. But it does mean that we're going to be living with this issue for a little while, for the next few months. Mm. And again, it's partly because Australia and ourselves obviously have very little influence over how these satellite systems are organised and what satellites are where. But also it's because the use of these hotspots, particularly morning hotspots, is a low priority for most people, even those involved in fire management, because the people in southern Australia with the big forest fires, they don't really rely on these hotspots so much. Those fires are small, often in forested areas, move very quickly. They have aircraft and things like that. As people in the Australian remote and regional areas are some of the few people who really value these morning hotspots. And so that means it's not a high priority for the global satellite system.
Right. And once this new satellite has its hotspot data and is able to be sending that information out, how much of a difference do you think that's going to make in terms of the accuracy and how up-to-date the information is?
We hope it's going to make a big difference. To give you an idea, that Terra satellite is now putting out often less than 100 hotspots. Picks up less than 100 hotspots on an overpass. We hope that will increase by a factor of several times. We used to get 1,000 hotspots out of those passes. So we hope it'll be back to like what Terra was when it was at full capacity. And that means we should be getting those updates, in the morning, shortly after the fires are detected, within 20 minutes to an hour or so, usually, of when the fire is detected.
Okay. And so you said that the old satellite that's being replaced is, 25 or so years old. Do you think maybe more needs to be done to replace those satellites more regularly?
Well, and it will be done according to the plans. That satellite was an experimental satellite. It was only meant to be up there for 6 or 8 years, which is why I said it was a minor miracle. It's still there. It was, and so it's being replaced with an operational satellite, METOP. It's a weather satellite, but it can detect hotspots. And it will be replaced by other satellites every couple of years or so. So it'll be regularly replaced by other satellites.
And so another reason that we could be seeing issues and delays in picking up these hotspots is also because of cloud cover. Can you explain how that is impacting things for me, Peter?
Yeah, sure. So these are satellites. They're above the cloud. They can't see through the cloud to detect the fires. And so they work pretty well when, you know, the weather's relatively free of cloud. And typically during the winter times in a lot of arid Australia. But then as we get closer to the wet season, particularly in places like northern Queensland, then you get a lot more cloud cover. And it varies from year to year. So in northern Queensland anyway, this year has been a bit wetter and a bit cloudier than the previous couple of years. So if you're used to sort of the performance of the hotspot detection over the last couple of years, you might find that this year is worse because it's just one of those slightly cloudier years.
And Peter, was there anything else that you want to mention that we haven't touched on that you think is important to know?
Yeah, one thing it's worth mentioning is that, I mean, people might say, well, this is just not good enough. And they're right. Look, this isn't good enough. We're seeing that fire management, particularly in rural and regional Australia, is becoming more important, and we're getting increased frequency of bad fire weather. And the problem we have is that this is a national problem. Australia doesn't have its own satellite systems. We have very little control over these satellite systems, yet we're becoming more dependent on them. And so, I mean, one thing people can do is talk to their local politician, their local member, and just let them know how important it is that we have proper, well-functioning satellite systems that can detect fires. And some options open to the Australian government might be, for example, to look at accessing Chinese satellites that are up there now and are good replacements for Terra already. I admit there's problems with there are security concerns, obviously, about accessing Chinese satellites, but the Australian government might look at it if they know how important it is that we have good satellite monitoring of fires in Australia. It could also help.
That is Peter Jacklin from the North Australian Fire Information website, a.k.a. NAFI. He was speaking to Malin McCosker and explaining to you some of the issues NAFI is facing because of old satellites. Just looking at the NAFI website this afternoon, well, there's been some good rain around the territory, so thankfully there's not too many fires in the landscape as we go to air this afternoon, which is great. According to the NAFI website, there is a bit of fire on the Bradshaw Defence Base to the northwest of Timber Creek. There's a little fire near Renner Springs, it would seem. A few blazes along the Tenami and a fire near Alice Springs. I thought I heard earlier that perhaps a fire had broken out at the local rubbish tip. Is that correct? There is a little hotspot near Alice Springs. Is that the dump? Let me know. 0487 99 1057 is our text number here at the country. I got a text here from Paul. He says he's out at the little cafe there on the Nightcliff foreshore. He says, Matt, it is going to rain here soon and rain hard. It is getting windy out at Nightcliff, reports Paul.
Join the ultimate party this New Year's Eve across the ABC with a massive lineup, including Melanie C, plus the famous Sydney Fireworks, audio described on the ABC Listen app.
Happy New Year!
On ABC TV and iView and the ABC Listen app.
To some resources news now, Core Lithium, which owns that mothballed lithium mine out the back of Berry Springs, that company looks to have ditched plans to become a uranium miner. I'm joined in the studio by Tom Robinson. Core Lithium, what's the news? What's happened?
Well, just today, Core told the ASX that it had sold four tenements in the territory and two in South Australia that focus there on uranium. So these are the Napperby, Fitton and Entia uranium projects. Mm-hmm. Sold it to that company Elevate Uranium in a deal worth $5 million in cash and shares, and it's pretty clear they're, you know, it's Core Lithium and they're focusing on lithium. as the CEO told the ASX, Paul Brown, he said, it sharpens our strategic focus as a lithium developer and advances our Finniss operation towards a restart. So as you say, that's the mothballed thing they've got there in Berry Springs. So look, there's probably a lot more to come on that before they can restart work at Finniss.
Yeah, the Country Hour has invited Core Lithium to come on this program a number of times in the last 6 months, and we have had no luck. I know a lot of people interested to know if 2026 will see that mine resume production, but we don't know. But they've got an extra $5 million in the bank by the looks of things, Tom. Thanks for keeping us up to date.
Hi, it's Dwayne Klinkamer here on board the Austral Hunter, part of the Northern Prawn Fishery, and we're in the Mooring Basin, or better known as the Duck Pond in Darwin, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Oh, and we've been sent a picture of it bucketing down in the northern suburbs of Darwin. Matt, the rain has started, and it's very dark out here. See, where I broadcast from, I'm in an absolute box. No windows. I've got no idea what's outside the ABC here in Darwin. Producer Tom, is it raining yet? Golly, must be close. And where is the monsoon? We are on monsoon trough watch this afternoon. It's meant to be here in the next 24 hours or so. I'll be speaking to the Weather Bureau in 5 minutes' time. As always, if you've got a question for the Bureau, send it through on the text number 0487 99 1057. It's now time on the Country Hour to head to the newsroom, 1 o'clock.
G'day, it's Brent Murdoch. I'm the Director and General Manager of Vista Gold. I look after the Mount Todd project, and we always listen to the Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, you'll meet the latest company that's on the hunt for rare earths in the Northern Territory. You will also be hearing from the Arid Lands Environment Centre, which has some concerns about the government's draft plan for managing buffel grass. And before 1:30 this afternoon, let's talk about prawns. Do you buy them peeled or unpeeled? And we are hearing from you this afternoon. The text number for the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. Got a message here from Mark, and we really appreciate this, Mark. So I mentioned earlier that the NAFI website was showing a fire near Alice Springs. And yes, Mark says, Matt, the dump is closed in Alice Springs today due to a fire. Have a great Christmas to you and the team, says Mark. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for keeping us all up to date. A fire in the dump, that's no good. How did that start? Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. Sally, the monsoon, where is it? What's going on?
Well, it's almost here. If anybody looks at a satellite picture across the Timor Sea, you can see these lines of showers and storms coming in, and that's what we typically see with the monsoon, with the high clouds streaming off back up to the northwest. So it's pretty close there. To call it, we've really just need another 24 hours of those winds to maintain, just so that we know that the observation wasn't just a one-off. So, but we'll confirm in the next 24, 36 hours, but yeah, it's pretty close.
Okay. And meanwhile, the Bureau, just a few moments ago, updated the flood watch for parts of the Barkly and Carpentarial coastal rivers. What can you tell us?
Well, basically, we've got that 07, what was 07 news, come on shore, and we've got now got a trough extending across the Gregory and the northern parts of the Barkly. And the lows that are just sitting there and just helping to kick off those showers and storms. We've had a surge come up from down south, so we've got a bit of wind on the southern side of that trough, which is also helping the rain. And so we've got a flood watch for basically the Barkly, mainly the northern half of the Barkly and the eastern parts of the Carpentaria. But everything's sort of fairly slow moving at the moment, and we'll see some of the rivers respond and water over land. We also there's a risk that we're also going to get some heavy falls that may lead to flash flooding. And so we keeping a very close eye on the storms for even sort of heavier rainfall, but sort of shorter period and in more isolated areas. So just keep an ear out for any warnings, any severe thunderstorm warnings that go out to cover that.
During this period of our first monsoonal burst of the season, how much rain is possible for some areas?
If you're looking over the course of the about 3 or 4 days, we could see sort of 100 mils in the Barkly Carpentaria, even once you get a bit further into the eastern parts, we could be seeing 150, up maybe up to 200 over that 4 days. But once you go a bit further east, we're seeing sort of lower totals, but it's still going to be reasonably wet.
Got a few questions from our audience. First one is, Sally, is there a low that's developing in the Barkly and Central Australia, and how uncommon is that?
Well, what we've got is there is a low there. It's across, is it in the trough? And we do see, if a low is going to develop, it's normally within the trough. We do occasionally see these lows that develop over land, and they can sort of develop quite sort of strong sort of circulations. This one will end up going towards Queensland, and I think that's when we gets hit by a bit more of a monsoonal surge. So, yeah, we do see them often. Probably more common to see them more into the Tanami rather than the Barkly, but we do see them.
Another question here from someone says, "Love me a Rosby wave. What's it up to, and what's the MJO doing?"
Well, an MJO is approaching. If you're looking at on our website with the animation of where the green is, it's going to have a positive impact, or rather, a positive as in more rain impact. It is picking up a little bit sort of through central parts of the NT, but most of it's still back out over the sort of Indian Ocean. The Rosby wave is actually quite weak, so it's just interesting that we've had such a big pickup. I think the Rosby wave might have triggered 07U, but then it sort of got itself organised and self-sustaining.
Yeah. I've mentioned Paul in Nycliffe reporting big rain and lots of wind. In terms of rainfall figures, up to 9 o'clock this morning, Conway's cattle station, 104 in the gauge, Hidden Valley station reporting 90, Beetaloo 76, Gove Airport 67, Victoria River Downs cattle station 55, Birrandoodoo 54, Bachelor Airport 48, Middle Points had 48, and across the border I see the Wyndham ports had over 100 millimetres as well. So it's getting wet out there, Sally.
Yep, it certainly is, and this is what happens when you have some fairly long the trough, you get some, the storms moving much slower. So that doesn't quite explain that the Conway's one, but there's obviously some really good falls up around the Catherine area or the Conway's area into the Roper. So, yeah, there are certainly some big falls out there.
Anything else we should be aware of this afternoon before you go?
Probably if you're down in the Leicester-Simpson area, it's going to be hot and sunny, but the rest of the NT is certainly going to be wet. So if you're moving around, just be aware that sort of the roads will be wet, and just be careful of any creeks that have come up, and particularly, especially sort of more major ones through that central parts of the NT.
Yeah, I saw a video this morning of a fair bit of water over the Stuart Highway. Must have been down near Tennant Creek somewhere, because Mount Skinner reported 100 millimetre plus in just 2 hours there on Sunday. So it's potentially the flow-on effects of that, quite literally.
Yeah, and that's probably something else to remember. Just because it hasn't rained where you are, it might have rained upstream.
Yeah.
So that water's got to come down the river, so just be aware that just because it might look okay now, the standard thing, don't hang around dry riverbeds.
Yeah, yeah. All right then, Sally, thanks so much. Have a lovely afternoon.
Will do, thanks.
Keep your garden growing strong with ABC Organic Gardener magazine. Inside you'll find summer pruning advice, organic pest solutions, and our expert guide to eggplants at newsagents or abcmagazines.com.au.
Yeah, well, here we go. I've just brought up the Road Report NT website, and sure enough, here it is. There's a caution in place for 30 to 80 kilometres south of Tennant Creek. Road has been damaged and there's water over the road at various locations. Motorists are advised to drive to the conditions. So there you go. There's been some, well, it's been a bit isolated, but there's been some big rain in that part of the territory. So if you're travelling along the Stuart Highway, just be aware of that.
The summer of cricket just got hotter. ABC Cricket Magazine is out now. Full season preview, all the stats, profiles, scorecards and more in your essential season guide. Out now at newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
The Territory Government has finally released its draft plan for managing buffel grass. And you've now got about 8 weeks to jump onto the website and have your say on this plan. The Arid Lands Environment Centre's Alex Vaughan says the plan is catastrophic for the environment, and he can't believe that the government would continue to allow for the sale and spread of buffle grass seed.
The Arid Lands Environment Centre condemns Minister Burgoyne's catastrophic buffle grass decision, which we see as caving to industry lobbying and puts his own community at risk by unilaterally continuing to permit the sale, trade and planting of buffle grass across the Northern Territory's pastoral leases. ALEC understands that a risk-based approach was the recommendation that was adopted by the majority of members on the Buffle Grass Weed Advisory Committee. It raises serious concerns what the role of these committees are if the minister is going to overrule and ignore the recommendation of his own committee. We think that this is not an evidence-based decision and goes against the expert evidence that exists, as well as this recommendation, his own community interests, and the fact that buffle grass poses grave risks to communities and landscapes across the Northern Territory.
What do you think pastoral leases should be made to do?
We think, from what is being promoted, that the continued unregulated sale, trade and use of buffle grass seed is not the way forward. We recognise that areas where on-ground management is wanted is a logical place to focus on, including national parks, Indigenous protected areas and Crown land. But continuing to potentially make the problem worse brings sustained risk, and continuing to allow the use and sale and trade of buffle grass seed is not the way forward. And is not a risk-based approach, which was adopted by the majority of members of the Northern Territory's Buffle Grass Weed Advisory Committee.
How common is it for cattle stations in the Red Centre to buy buffle grass seed?
Pushing back on that, we're unsure why a unilateral permit is being provided across for all the Northern Territory, not knowing the ongoing impacts and where seed is going. It sends the wrong message around the Northern Territory Government's approach to managing a weed in the Northern Territory, as in it is totally reasonable approach to limit and stop the sale of a seed that is a weed.
I listened to the interview with Amber Clark, who's the Buffle Program Manager for the Northern Territory, who talked about cattle stations needing to do reasonable measures to prevent the spread into the neighbour's place. If it's a neighbouring property that doesn't want buffle, what's your understanding on what a reasonable measure is?
We're not sure at this point in time,
yep.
But we're keen to hear more. And to be really clearly, we're keen for this to take a holistic approach and to understand the views of all stakeholders. But privileging one interest group above another is not the way forward. And we do believe that taking reasonable steps around buffle grass invasion means that we should limit the sale, spread and use of seed. As we know that buffle grass will move across landscapes, and it does pose a grave threat to environments, cultures and public safety across the Northern Territory.
And just finally, Alex, this is a draft plan. It's open for public comment for the next 8 weeks or so. How confident are you that there could be tweaks made to this later on?
I think there will be a widespread community response to this and support for stronger action to be taken. And we hope that the Northern Territory Government listens widely to what, this is the bare minimum, really. We're talking about legislative mechanisms here. This is not about total management of buffle grass, which doesn't necessarily need law. But we'll hope that the Northern Territory Government hears loudly and clearly that there's strong calls for community-wide support for coherent, comprehensive and evidence-based action around buffle grass. We cannot keep promoting the seed of a weed to be totally unregulated. It's dangerous, and we need to learn from the past and start working towards a positive vision for the arid and semi-arid lands here today in the future, and listen to all stakeholders in this story.
That's Alex Vaughan, who's the Policy and Advocacy Coordinator of the Arid Lands Environment Centre. As mentioned, you've got about 8 weeks to have your say on this draft plan. You just search for Have Your Say NT on the internet and bang, you're in business. On the text line, a message here from Adrian, who says the draft NT Buffleweed Management Plan has come out in the NT government's December dirty laundry. It puts responsibility on people and groups in town to manage buffle, but under the plan, the minister can grant an industry-wide permit for pastoral leases to be exempt from requirements. In other words, says Adrian, it appears pastoralists will essentially be free to ignore this plan and keep planting buffle. It is 19 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. A relative newcomer to the Territory's resources sector is hoping to strike it rich in the Territory next year. Barkley Rare Earths, formerly called Transition Minerals, lodged a prospectus with ASIC at the start of this month and is looking to raise $8 million to help with its exploration work, which is happening about 350 kilometres to the northwest of Tennant Creek. Executive Chairman Gavin Lockyer told Charles Geary more about the plans and what the company is hoping to do in 2026.
We've done some initial exploration in the region using private funding, and that was sufficient to identify an initial mineral resource. So the $8 million from the prospectus, which is fully underwritten, by the way, so we're pretty comfortable we will achieve that target. Obviously, the $8 million will then go to enhancing the exploration programs throughout 2026, as you identified.
And you're feeling confident that that $8 million target will be reached?
Yeah, look, it's fully underwritten by Lewin Wealth Management, an advisory firm here in Perth, Western Australia. So we're very comfortable that the $8 million will come in. And I know just on the subscriptions through the various lists that I've seen, it's well and truly well supported.
This prospectus period is for raising money for that Barkley project. Can you tell us a little bit about that Barkley project you have? It's a rare earths project, I believe.
Yes, correct. It also contains a vanadium prospect or actual resource, but that's not our focus. The focus for the prospectus and the funds from that prospectus will be on Barkley region. The project already has a inferred mineral resource of 40 million tonnes of at 2,100 parts per million rare earths. And the exploration target is looking to increase that to somewhere between 200 million and 1 billion tonnes. So that'll be one of the primary objectives of the target, as well as to confirm the grade. And in the background, we'll also be working on some metallurgy to prove up the extraction processes.
Things don't tend to move particularly quickly in the resources space. What's the estimated timeline, I guess, for one, to get to this next drilling project, but also commercial production?
Look, yeah, you're dead right. The rare earths game is typically pretty tough in terms of timelines and predictability of when production might happen. What I will say is that the geology that has been identified to date and the mineralogy to date would indicate that this should be a very low cost mining exercise with a fairly simple flow sheet, so much more simple than a hard rock deposit like many that you may be familiar with in the Northern Territory. So I'm hoping that the timeline can be greatly shortened compared to some of the others that are out in the public domain at the moment. But really, our focus is next year on drilling out the resource, increasing the tonnage, shoring up the rare earth mineralogy, and shoring up the extraction process so that we can clearly identify what process we will need to either build at site or in the region in order to be able to effectively extract the product.
That is the Barkley Rare Earths Executive Chairman, Gavin Lockyer, speaking to Charles Geary. Up next on the Country Hour, let's talk about prawns. If you're planning to buy some for the Christmas period, do you go for convenience, price, or sustainability? The Marine Stewardship Council has been researching people on their prawn consumption habits. I'll share the results of that with you next.
Yeah, g'day, how you going? My name's Jason Moon, owner of NT Tropical Passion Fruit. We're on the farm today, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
If you're buying some prawns for Christmas, are you going to get the peel your owns, or do you buy the pre-peeled prawns? The Marine Stewardship Council has been doing some research into our prawn consumption habits and has found that convenience is proving more important than the price, and definitely more important than sustainability. Dr. Adrian Gutteridge explains.
I guess first is that, you know, 60% of Aussies will prefer to buy pre-peeled prawns so they don't have to do it themselves, which is something that, you know, my household, I grew up in a place where, you know, you peel your prawns and that's the ones you eat. So the more you peel, the more you eat. But yeah, from Marine Stewardship Council's perspective, one of the other interesting findings was that even though, you know, 60% of people are looking for pre-peeled prawns, only about 16% are actually bringing sustainability into their sort of purchasing sphere when they're going to buy prawns. And, you know, from our perspective, we'd love to see that get higher, because at the moment there's about 2/3 of wild caught prawns in Australia that carry the MSC blue fish tick label. So it's kind of never been easier to buy sustainable prawns. So that's what we're really kind of pushing this year for people to do.
So yeah, so when people go into the supermarket or the fish market or wherever they're buying their prawns from, whether it's frozen or fresh, there are, as you say, there are a number, a decent number that have that certification that people could be choosing from?
Yeah, that's right. And you can do that in your local supermarket or your fishmonger. And, you know, for people out there, a thing to remember is your most powerful conservation tool is your wallet. And so the purchasing power you have really sends messages to, you know, fisheries and organisations and companies about what you're actually wanting out of those products. And yeah, for people, we're just saying, you know, the blue fish tick MSC logo is a really easy way to identify that that prawn or seafood product, whatever it is, comes from a sustainable fishery. And that is, you know, the number one thing we're asking Aussies to do this year when it comes to buying prawns.
So I'm looking at that tick, that label on a fish product or prawns or whatever it is. Yep. Essentially, what does that mean? What is that telling me as a consumer? What's it guaranteeing me?
Well, it's guaranteeing you that that fishery has gone through a really rigorous process to demonstrate sustainability. So the MSC is a third-party independent certification scheme. And to carry that blue fish tick label, that fishery needs to demonstrate three key things. The first is that the target species, the thing that's carrying that blue fish tick, is in a sustainable manner and it's been demonstrated to stay there this generation and generations to come. The second thing is that the impacts of the wider ecosystem are low, such that it's not going to drive potentially bycatch species, for example, into oblivion. And the third is that they've got really strong management in place to give you all that kind of information. So the MSC is sort of the most rigorous independent sustainability certification in the world. So it really is, you know, a really high bar for sustainability and the kind of things that people can be, you know, certain that they're buying from a really well-managed fishery and a fishery that's doing the right thing to kind of ensure that that resource is here, not for this Christmas, but also, you know, all Christmases to come.
It's interesting looking at some of these purchasing trends, and you might think, well, is it a cost thing because of a cost of living crisis? People are still buying prawns, but maybe they're looking for the slightly cheaper option. So they might be some of your more imported varieties, or maybe they're ones that, you know, for some reason, whatever reason, they're not signed up to this program. Do you think that might be what consumers are looking for first?
Yeah, perhaps. And I mean, I guess contrary to that idea that, you know, the cost of living crisis is making people choose cheaper options, like it's actually more expensive to buy pre-peeled prawns. So, you know, that kind of shows that the convenience of, you know, not having to deal with, I guess, shells and heads once you get home is probably more factoring in that purchasing thing. But, you know, when it comes to imported versus, you know, Australian wild-caught prawns, you know, the price difference isn't going to be all that much different, especially at, you know, your kind of bigger supermarkets. And, you know, I guess the thing that would differentiate my purchasing, for example, is knowing that the prawns that are Australian caught, wild caught, carrying the MSC blue fish tick label, you know, that fishery is in our own waters. They're really well managed. And yeah, I guess if that kind of cost of imported prawns is coming into it, the thing I would just ask people to do is just consider where that's come from and what that regulation might be in another country, because, you know, they're unlikely to be in the same kind of realm that Australia's wild caught prawns are.
That is Dr. Adrian Gutteridge from the Marine Stewardship Council speaking to Selena Green. I can't believe that 60% of Aussies are buying the pre-peeled prawns. I thought we were a nation of peelers, but apparently not. Just finally to the text line, and this is a text regarding our earlier conversation about Bufflegrass. The draft plan is now out for public comment. Tom says the guy from ALEC refers to following the evidence. Sure, let's do that, because all of the evidence says that Bufflegrass should not be classified as a weed. It's virtually impossible to control and certainly unaffordable and unproductive to try, says Tom, who says he's looking forward to the wet season and watching his Bufflegrass grow. That's it for today's Country Hour, folks. I'll see you tomorrow for a Christmas Eve edition of the Country Hour. And hopefully we will be talking about the official arrival of the monsoon. Keep it rural.